What up, what up, people of the internet? You are listening to another episode of Hidden Apron Radio with me, Paulo Espanola, where we talk to the most fascinating people in the world of food, many of whom defy labels and straddle multiple disciplines from business, art, science, to good old cooking. We try to stick to one topic, but as with conversations with interesting people, we always end up going on multiple tangents from the politics of farming, the philosophy of food access, and the right way to create a menu. If this is the first time you're tuning into our show, you might want to check out the previous episode, as this is actually part two of a two-part series with the ever-impressive Eileen Suzara, eco-educator, writer, and natural chef. Eileen has been recognized many times for her work, not only in addressing some of the most pressing food issues affecting us today, but also in strengthening relationships in her community in the process. She founded Sariwa, which means fresh in Tagalog, to gather community and celebrate Filipino cuisine through pop-ups, catering, and workshops. Now, in the last episode, we covered her background and how she's managed to integrate the many parts of her life into one cohesive story. It's the perfect episode for many of us, including myself, who have struggled with trying to answer the question of what should I do with my life. We also covered some basic techniques to become a self-sufficient cook and her mindsets on both growing food, as she's a farmer, and cooking food, which is the chef side of her. In this episode, we delve a bit deeper into Sariwa and how it can be used to integrate food into the healthcare space. We also take a philosophical look into the theme of resistance, whether that means resistance to healthy food, resistance to inauthentic food, quote unquote, and many more, maintaining presence and sanity, and the things that keep us from achieving our dreams. Like I said, this was probably one of the most enjoyable episodes that I've had the honor of recording and editing to date, and I highly, highly suggest you listen to the end, as Eileen has some pretty sage advice that applies not just to food, but to life itself, which is the direction that we're taking this show, as we want to showcase just how food is not only pervasive in all aspects of our life, but that it does affect the way we live in many ways that we don't normally think of outside of the realm of perhaps nutrition. With that said, onto the show.
So this second half, I actually didn't intend for this second half to be structured this way. But when I was crafting these questions, they kind of coalesced into this central theme of resistance. I don't know if it's just because we're living in these times that I'm getting subliminal messaging everywhere. I'll start out with one of the lighter questions is, you mentioned a lot about healthy food or food that's supposed to contribute to your health. And I know that even just the term healthy food, I myself have gotten a lot of resistance, right? When I say, like, you should eat healthier. And people will be like, oh, the healthy food doesn't taste good, or it's expensive, or, you know, that's bougie shit, whatever.
Yeah.
And how have you helped people get over that initial resistance?
Yeah, good question. And that's another spin on resistance, right? And where does that come from? Mm-hmm. And I will just preface and say that I remember when I was, I think I was 21 at the time. I was in the Southwest and I had this invitation to join these incredible young First Nations folks who were doing a sovereignty and food and self-determination gathering. And as a Filipino American, to get to join that, felt like a really beautiful invitation. So I was there. And I remember we each, all the young participants were there, were invited to come up and to introduce themselves and their favorite food. And I went up there and shared my name, and I said my favorite food was Spam.
Oh.
And there was some familiarity. Yeah. But the funny thing was that I was actually apprenticing that summer at a seed bank or a seed farm, a native seed farm in Arizona. Mm-hmm. And was surrounded by this whole movement for sustainable foods. And I just remember after I said Spam, and then other young people came up and were introducing themselves and then sharing about the food of their ancestors or food that they were reclaiming and how food was connected to resistance. I suddenly had the deepest regret that I had said that my favorite food was Spam. Cause like, oh no, why did I say that? I had grown up with a lot of familiarity and affection for Spam, but I'm like, oh no, that was not a cool thing to say. And, later as I was reflecting that, I was like, oh, you know, that approach is something that I weirdly still try to borrow from today. I think when people often hear the word healthy, there can be a lot of pushback because it can feel bougie or exclusionary or, you know, class-based. And the truth is that for a lot of folks, you know, we might have food that might fall into the not healthy camp and actually, you know, feel connected to it. And that's real, right? So I guess when I encounter any resistance around the term healthy, what I think is really important to do is to try to ground it in a non-judgmental sounding kind of way. And also emphasize, I think when we emphasize a sense of culture about it, making sure it's not saying, you know, healthy, like eat kale and eat things that come from Whole Foods, but healthy, like let's eat things that, you know, are actually part of our celebratory foods, or it's foods that have a linkage to our histories. I think that there's far more openness and excitement around it. Yeah, and I guess ultimately too is ensuring that healthy does not become equated with tasteless is important. I think people, all of us, I mean, who really wants to eat healthy food if it's bland and boring and doesn't give us life? So I think we need to find ways to make sure that that is there too.
I am going to send you this book that I think actually helped with this question of why, there's actually a reason why healthy food became equated with tastelessness here in America, at least, at the very least. I think part of it was like religion, and part of it was this whole temperance thing. Like if it's very flavorful, it'll affect the humors in your body and affect your mood and all that. So there were actually these sanatoriums or clinics that were set up where people had to eat just bland food because that was the way they could reset. You know, graham crackers was what used to be marketed as a health thing. It was this hard, bland thing. And I'm like, you guys messed it up for all of us. Like, you're already eating healthy.
Thanks a lot, guys. Yeah,
I stumbled on this book. I should definitely send this to you. It's a side note.
I want to geek out on that side note, but I know we have to hold back. I can't wait to read that. Love it.
So what did we cover? We covered the resistance to healthy food. The other resistance that I wanted to go over was more on the mindset part, is questions of authenticity and tradition. Because I'm pretty sure if people looked at your food, I'm sure there's at least one person who looks at it and says, like, yo, this ain't Filipino. Mm-hmm. So how have you addressed that part?
Yeah, absolutely. I think what I would address is to say, this is food that might look different, but you know, I would say I actually choose not to use the term authentic when I describe the food.
Interesting.
Because I think one is this is representing more of a Filipino American experience. And I know that unless I was actually in the Philippines cooking foods from the land there, cooking it here, cooking in the kitchen here, cooking with different varieties of foods, I think it should maybe channeling a kindred spirit. But it's still something that is coming from this place, not just from me personally, but also just from where we are physically. And yeah, I think that's why actually I shy away from authentic. You know, if other folks choose to identify with that, with their food, you know, more power to them. But I often find that getting caught in questions of what is authentic and what is not, you know, food culture changes. I would like to believe that if there was an alternative sci-fi universe where you know the U.S. didn't occupy the Philippines, or migration from the Philippines to the U.S. happened through totally different means, I think that food cultures would shift and adapt anyways. That's just part of, you know, migration and history and how people trade things. So I would just love to think about food adapting in the diaspora is kind of its own expression too.
Right. Then in that case, if you take the root of authentic, isn't that being authentic in itself? You know, you're living the experience that you've had through food. Mm. If we take that further down, though, so on the flip side, if there's a camp that says what you're cooking is inauthentic, with where you see Filipino food as a whole in America going today, being very exciting. Like I was just in a line for like 20 minutes to get this Ube software the other day. But that aside, do you feel like we're going completely in the other direction where Filipino food is in danger of becoming overly accommodating in America?
That is a fascinating question, and I think there are probably a ton of different perspectives on that. I think I would be curious at really understanding and hearing maybe this expressed in Filipino foods. Is, I love to know when there is a regional influence happening in a dish, even if it's being interpreted here in the US. Like, oh, what region is that from? I think maybe one of the challenges of coming from, a place of 7,000 islands, some of which were not, really one unified archipelago in perpetuity in the past, is you have so many regional variations, and then folks from their personal and family and community migrations are cooking it here in the US. Yeah, what are those regional variations? And I think that is sometimes not really spelled out when people are presenting their food to the public. And that maybe sometimes that is intentional, but I think that that can break up this like monolith idea of what Filipino food is supposed to be.
It's more complex than adobo and I don't know, ube. Side question, what regional influence is in your cooking, by the way? Because I think I totally forgot to ask what region your parents are from.
Regional influences. So my mom's side is from Pangasinan, the land of salt. Yeah, my dad is from Bicol. And
Ooh,
I would
Bicol,
say, in
okay.
a lot of ways, yeah, Bicol definitely influences my palate so much. And I think, as someone who then went on to grow up in Hawaii, which, being surrounded by a number of other Pacific cultures that have foods with coconut milk in it, that really continued to resonate. And I would say that maybe Bicol might be one of the strongest Philippine-based influences in the food that I love to cook. But I
Awesome.
have so much curiosity around one of the, oh, we kind of pref started to get on this tangent, I think, in one of our messages, was always longing to know more of the foods of Mindanao as well.
Yeah, I actually bookmarked I think one website covered I think a cooking class you did with all coconut based. And I saw
Yes.
bina colos on there. I'm like, yes. Yes. I was so like happy.
Binacol, I love it. And that was probably, weirdly enough, that was one of the very few Filipino dishes that my mom cooked when I grew up. And she waited until I was 16, and I remember coming home. She had binacol cooking on the stove. And I was like, what is this? She's like, oh, I just thought about this. I'm like, you thought about this 30 years later, and now we're eating this? And that was a touchstone recipe for my mom's side. Other tangent, but I think that was the personal significance of that one dish as well.
It's almost like a like righteous indignation, like how could you withhold this?
I was like, this is so good. And then
Wow.
having like regret for like the rest of my, the part of my life where I didn't know it existed.
And I don't know if part of it is like he like oh my kids are never gonna like this because I often hear that actually. It's like why don't you cook this? Like you know this recipe and they're like ah oh, my kids don't eat that. They eat grilled cheese sandwich. I'm like are you sure about that? But neither here nor there. Continuing on this thread of resistance, I do know that you have a I stumbled on like this site, Delicious Revolution. I know there's another podcast episode of you coming out in June of this year, right?
Yes, it
So
is.
I don't want to spend too much time on this so that they could cover that in theirs, but I did want to quickly touch on this idea of decolonizing food. I think in certain circles, that's a very common phrase now. There's a lot of pop-ups who are doing it. I think that term is very it's used comfortably already in certain circles, but you know, for those who have never heard of it before, how would you quickly describe colonized food and the process of decolonizing it?
Okay. All right. The nutshell. Can you even nutshell decolonization? That is a question in and of itself.
Oof.
but I guess what I would just share about decolonization, it's true. It is a word that is used more openly in certain circles. And when I just to preface what I first heard of it wasn't in a Filipino context at all. It was in Hawaii. And being surrounded in a place where decolonization was part of, I think, a community's conversation around their relationship to land and sovereignty and food, like that was a turning point. I was like, oh, what does this question of self-determination, decolonization, what do these things mean as a Filipino American? And I guess now, what does that mean to Filipino food or food in general, even without the marker of Filipino. I think in part, decolonization, what I've taken to heart is that it somewhat begins in the mind. It's this understanding of, okay, if you have the influences of generations worth of colonization, a lot of which I think has, you know, kind of added this layer of, what is prioritized? What is seen as the norm? What are the invisible norms that we have? Is it whiteness? Is it a Eurocentric worldview? And being able to open that up within your own mind. And with decolonization, specifically around food, I think it's looking at food from a lens of, okay, you know, how did this food come to us? Is it through an exploitive process? How are workers affected in getting this food from the fields to folks' tables? And even as I hold this, you know, Recipes of the Philippines book, why is it that the cover of the book, you know, for example, has an American ham with pineapple and maraschino cherries on it and apples, but on the inside, the ones that don't get the color photography are the more like native delicacies? Is there a story there? So I don't know if I really broke that down, but I think those are just some of the examples that I think of even holding something like a book.
Well, correct me if I'm misinterpreting it, because what it sounded like to me was you're describing this thing that isn't just dead history. Like, it's not something in the past, because so I'm in a couple of Facebook food groups, and there's one in particular where terms decolonization or appropriation are brushed aside, mainly because the group is not very colored, so to speak. You know, a lot of the people in that group are esteemed food writers who don't have the experience of a person of color. So oftentimes they'll say, like, dude, this happened in the past. Like, this is history, get over it. Or they'll say, like, oh, you know, in the past this was really Italian and who knows where it all started, so this shouldn't even be discussed. But what you're describing is, you know, even like in terms of the experiences of growers today, this isn't done. This isn't like an earmark in history that we can just like move past. It's, I don't know if I understood your nutshell correctly, but is that a fair assessment?
That's, yeah, absolutely fair. And I think it's remembering it's not, you know, it's not something to ever check off of a list and say it's done. I think it's realizing like, okay, these markers, they still exist now, whether they're acknowledged or not, seen or not. And how do we name them? How do we undo them? And what are the ways that they're still being perpetuated today in ways that we could still break it down towards something more healing?
Got you. Is there a reason why? So one of the things that you sent over to me earlier by email was the writing collaboration with Hella Pinay. And in it, you featured kamote, which in English is what? I'm blanking.
Oh, in English, it's a sweet potato.
Sweet potato. Is there a reason why you chose sweet potato to feature in there?
Yeah, I think, well, it was really sweet. Haha, it was sweet. So when Hella Pinay, I was like, I was not even trying to run with that one. When Hella Pinay reached out, you know, we were just batting some ideas around, and I'd always actually wanted to do this in the personal, you know, writing practice, but it was even more exciting to do it with them. Was to say, oh, how can we have like a monthly spotlight on an ingredient, a crop, and where would be a place to begin? It's like, well, that seems easy, you know. Summertime, okra, tomatoes, we could easily have a recipe and a story attached to each of those. But right now we're in winter. We're also in a time of resistance, I think, politically. And, you know, even just season-wise, we're in a time when things are still coming out of their dormancy. So it seemed like a time to focus on sweet potatoes, on kamote, as it's a food that is present in Filipino food. I think it also seems to unite a lot of different food cultures that all have a story or a relationship to the sweet potato, and it has an incredible history in its own right as a traveling route.
Yeah. I when you put in there the etymology of it, I was so surprised. So I'm gonna also put the link of this piece, because I think it was an eye opening one to share an experience. I know the whole topic of the piece was decolonization, but I think that was uber interesting to me to see why you chose that ingredient. And it'd be really cool to read any future pieces if you kind of do that, you know, and work it around any ingredient. This is an opinion question, so there's really no right or wrong on this, but this was something I asked in one of the previous episodes, so I'm interested to see what your take on this is. But do you feel like healthy food is a luxury? So not whether you think it should be or shouldn't, because I think we can all agree that everyone should eat healthy food. But do you think in the state of the food economy today, is healthy food a luxury?
And we're saying in the US or anywhere?
Wherever you think you can speak to. So if you think you want to speak on both Philippines and US, completely fine.
I'll speak to here mostly because I know, yeah, I think I'll speak to what is around us here right now. It's a funny question. Is healthy food a luxury? On one hand, you know, we're in the US, there's like massive overproduction of commodity crops, right? Think of things like wheat or soy. And at the same time, there seems to be difficulties in food access in so many communities to reach foods that aren't just, you know, calories, but just foods that are going to support their well-being, foods that are going to resonate with their culture too. I think healthy food might be perceived as a luxury, but I think healthy food has unfortunately become something that is a challenge for certain communities to access. Not just in cities, which I think is sometimes the way that the picture is painted, but even in rural communities, or even in farm worker communities, right? You have this irony that you might have folks who have the skills and who put their labor into tending, you know, fresh fruits and vegetables, but you know, because of pay, are not able to actually bring that sort of food home back to their own tables. So yeah, so these are I think it's just it's a funny question. It is and it isn't. I think if it came down to can you actually make healthy food on, say, like a food stamp budget or a lower income budget, you can. I think it's just sometimes a matter of time. It's a matter of access, and I think that has been artificially curtailed by policies that don't necessarily support communities of color or working class communities.
And I think that's a question that I still need to refine that question because it is a pretty recent one, but I do want to try to highlight, you know, from this interview and future interviews that a lot of times when people say food is a luxury, or when a roommate tells me, like, man, that's bougie shit, I think there's something to be said about the fact that you said it's artificially there. If, you know, a lot of times it is a luxury because we've artificially made it so through, you know, backward-looking policies that probably don't make sense if we were trying to make communities healthier. Which is probably a good transition because I wanted to talk about moving forward, how you are actually addressing things like this in your community. You mentioned Sariwa earlier. Could you quickly go through what Sariwa is and what you're trying to do with it today?
Sure. So Sariwa, which means fresh in Tagalog and Filipino. It's just a project that was born out of a community pop-up. It evolved while I was finishing up a master's in public health nutrition as a way of bringing storytelling and a food sort of experience within communities to tap their perceptions of, quote, healthy Filipino food and what they thought about it and how they related to ingredients. And from that, it's become a food business that's now an incubation at La Cocina, which is a commercial kitchen in San Francisco that really works to lift up and support women-led food businesses, especially among immigrant and POC communities. And what I want to do with it, right now, I want to see Sariwa be able to exist in, you know, the food world of the Bay Area. But something that's going to channel together these, you know, a love for working and friendship with growers, small farmers, especially farmers of color, who are, you know, who put all of their love and skills into growing amazing foods, and shepherding, you know, heritage seeds back to life, and also just bridging the community in a way that's accessible and family friendly. with Filipino inspired foods. My heart's dream about this, which I'm going to share with you now, is I really want to figure out a way how to bring these these foods and connect it to the healthcare environment. I don't see myself really trying to bring Sariwa as a restaurant that's going to be, you know, I think how we often think about food businesses is you're going to have the brick and mortar, you're going to try to get all the good reviews. That's incredible, and it's an incredible hustle, and I'm absolutely inspired by folks who do it that way.
Mm-hmm.
But I really want to find a way, like how to deliberately tie together a Filipino-American food business. I think in the setting where Filipino-Americans are often working in health environments, and or just like everyone else, we are actually going in there receiving services. So that remains to be seen how that's going to play out. That's a piece that's being developed even as I try to figure out more standard ways of getting the food out into the world at farmers markets and through catering. But ultimately, that is one of the core questions.
Could you clarify what you meant by bring food more into the health environment? Do you mean healthcare as an industry, so meaning healthier food in hospitals, just off the top of my head, or is it more food as a tool to create healthier communities? So that could be like community education.
More of the latter and a little bit of some of the former.
Okay.
And so I think what, in case anyone who's listening to this who happens to have pots of money lying around, if there was a way to have a physical space for a cafe type of environment where you could also have educational activities and that it could have a partnership with a hospital or a clinic, and that it is offering these, you know, culturally nuanced foods, that would be a dream for Sariwa. I think it's somewhat unusual, but just kind of having looked at the landscape across the U.S., and especially back in Hawaii, there are some examples of places that are saying like, okay, how can you have, you know, a culturally reflective food practice, and you're making a deliberate connection around building health and wellness for a community. And back when I was on Oahu, if you ever have the chance to go there, I highly, highly recommend these incredible people. There's a spot called Roots Cafe, and it's actually inside of a community clinic that also has a farm. And so I remember when I walked through those doors of the clinic, ate at this cafe where a lot of the food actually was being produced by growers who were, you know, just miles away from the vicinity of the clinic, and seeing the way people were coming together and eating foods that reflected who they were, it just felt very whole and very like just really beautiful. And if there's even some element that Sariwa could channel here, I think I would be fulfilling a really deep dream.
Oh my gosh. I quickly just pulled that book I was talking about a while ago.
Mm.
The one that, it's called Three Squares, Invention of the American Meal. Because I was like, I'm pretty sure I've heard this being done long time ago, minus the cultural component. So there's a guy, this physician who used to work with the guy who invented the graham cracker. He ran a place called Our Home in New York, which was a spa in like the 1800s, where people would basically come to renew their health through, quote unquote, here it says alternatives to traditional medicine, but it was all food. Basically, the therapy was food, and what their therapeutic application was water and a grain-based vegetarian diet. I think he was religious, so there was some religious aspect to it, if you want to call that the cultural component. And yeah, I think like the Kellogg brothers were involved with this before it became like a commercial cereal.
Oh.
Yeah, there's this whole chapter on how the breakfast industry in the U.S. started out as a healthcare industry. But
okay, gotta read this. Fascinating.
This is like a total tangent.
I'm loving the tangents as well.
Because I remember, yeah, this thing sparked in my head when you mentioned a space to connect people through food, but also be able to address this health thing, because I think that is a problem, right? We often disassociate the two, where if people say like food is medicine, it's seen as, oh, that's like some woo-woo Eastern Asian philosophy thing.
Right, like, or it's a graham cracker with nothing on it, right?
So. exactly. So I'd love to see where this is going to go. And I'm supposed to ask this much, much later towards the closing, but where can people actually follow the story of Sariwa today? Is there like a website or?
There is a website that is under development, but maybe by the time you post this, it might be live. So it's at sariwakitchen.com,
Okay.
and there's a Sariwa Facebook, so it could be followed there. I guess you'll never see it since you're off of Facebook, but for
Yeah.
those who are, you can follow it there as well.
Nice. Okay.
You're listening to Hidden Apron Radio, produced by myself, Paolo Espanola, and Ricky Ho. Just two ordinary guys trying to break bread and break boundaries. Thoughts, musings, ever just wanted to rant at us? Do let us know at hiddenapron@gmail.com or at hidden_apron on both Twitter and Instagram. Back to the show.
So we're at the top of the hour, so I'm nearing the end of the closing out. So there's one last section where I actually wanted to cover more about you personally rather than what you're doing, but how you're doing it. So one of the things that I noticed and I mentioned earlier is that you are everywhere on the web. So my question is, how do you go about, if you are at all, how do you go about maintaining your presence publicly and making sure that you're connected to the right stories? Are you actively saying like, I need to go to this so that I can get out there, or has this all been organic?
Interesting that you asked that, because last night I was telling my partner here, I was like, I have no idea where all these interviews are coming from. And I thought, oh, you know, I mean, it's so, I feel so honored to get to share stories. And I also am like, where is this all coming from? And I think it actually just really has been organic. You know, there's no way to say, hey, I really hope, you know, so-and-so reaches out to do an interview. I truly believe that maybe there's just some domino effect that happens once you have an interview out. Other people hear about you, and then it replicates itself. But generally, in choosing to do things, I just have to ask, like, does it feel right to be here? Is this a project that feels, you know, does this speak to where I want to be right now? Are these the people that feel good to collaborate with? And often the answer is yes, and then I'll go. And then we'll just see what happens when it comes out of it.
Oh, that's awesome. It's like the right seed to grow. Given that, are there certain things that you do, whether they're daily routines or practices, that help you balance all this? Because I can't imagine having the time to do interviews plus be in the programs that you're in, winning the awards that you are, and building the community programs that you are doing. Like, how do you go about balancing all this?
Personally, I think that there are a few things that work. One of them is journaling.
Oh, awesome. Okay.
Another of them, I have actually a whole bin of journals that I've kept since I was eight,
oh,
also.
Me too.
So eight.
Oh, not
oh,
that young,
we
but.
should, we should compare journals. Maybe I will have to hide some from you. There's a lot of stuff there. So yeah, I just have piles of journals. I don't know what to do with them, so I can't let go of them yet, though.
Yeah.
Journaling, building in time to reconnect with, you know, Mama Nature. This is where I sound like the brown hippie, but I think that is really the side of being grounded in is to just, you know, go outside somewhere and connect. And honestly, I feel like a lot of what I get to do is always done with other people in community. I really think that doing projects collaboratively, it always takes everyone a lot further, and then you just feed off of each other. So, when, you know, there are certain things, like, for example, building this food business. It's something that you just have to spearhead, but I feel like there are so many people who've offered their support and insights, you know, critiques or tools, and that's why any of it is possible. If I was just like alone in a room by myself, you know, I think none of this would be possible. It's all about being with other people.
Would you say you're an extrovert, by the way?
I think I'm an introvert who ends up getting put in extroverted situations. I took a test for this recently.
I'm
a
laugh.
Hermit on the inside who ends up being outside a lot.
Oh man, I laugh because that's my problem. Is I just want to stay in my room and read books, but why am I cooking food and having to be in front of people if I wanted
yeah,
to stay?
Yeah, what are we doing with ourselves?
I don't know. I don't know. It's masochism at its best.
Yeah,
Okay.
Right?
So this is the final section, and the questions are super short. You can answer them short if you'd like or expound. It's up to you. It's something that I ask everyone on the show. I actually stole it from another podcast I heard. I'm like, oh, this is a good practice. So here we go. First one is person who most influenced you. I would usually say from a cooking standpoint here, but because you're across so many disciplines, you pick which standpoint you want. So person who most influenced you and why?
Person who most influenced me. There are so many. I think for today, other than living relatives and passed away relatives, I would name a young adult author who really influenced me when I was a child, because I think that was the formative years. She wrote Wise Child. Her name is Monica Furlong. Okay. And despite writing about a child, a girl apprentice who was living in Cornwall, I somehow found her words to really speak to my soul at a very young age. And it's one of the only books I have kept my entire life.
Wait, what's the book about again?
It's called Wise Child. It's about a young girl who is like discovering her own powers in relationship to nature and earth. She ends up getting adopted and apprenticed underneath an herbal healer woman who's a hermit. So I'm like, oh, that probably influenced all the wantings to work with plants, be a bruja, and
be a hermit.
As a hermit.
Okay. Love it. Best cooking tool you've ever purchased?
Ooh. Best cooking tool I've ever purchased.
You can't say knife.
I am not saying a knife.
Okay.
I actually don't really like my knives, to be honest, but that I have currently. Sorry, knife. I hope you didn't hear that. But best cooking tool in terms of fun factor and not necessarily functionality is I love my coconut grater or coconut caballo, the little horse.
Oh,
because
wow.
It brings people, I think, joy if they haven't seen one for a long time. And if they have never seen one before, they're really excited to learn what it is.
How the heck did you make one or did you actually buy one?
I bought one, and then when I did that cooking for coconut workshop that you had read an article about, I was currently staying at a farm in Pescadero, clearly had no access to a coconut grater, put an ask out on Facebook that I really needed one within 24 hours, and someone just happened to be camping nearby and brought their coconut grater to me.
Oh,
so
wow.
I still have that one too.
Jeez. Okay. Three ingredients to describe you.
Oh, okay. That's easy. Chili, garlic, coconut.
Wow. People usually struggle with this one. Like, people really struggle with this one. That was the fastest. Have you been asked this before?
No, I'm easy, though. It's just that trifecta.
Wow. Okay. I'm. That's the easiest, like, the quickest answer. No, there was someone else who, I think Tita Amy also answered pretty quickly. And hers were all the adobo ingredients. She was like, oh, she named the ingredients of her adobo, and then she looked up and she was like, oh wow, I just named adobo ingredients. I guess you can call it adobo. One book or documentary or any resource that you would say every common person should read or watch, whatever.
Let's see. I'm just stuck on the book tip right now, but one of my favorite collections of stories is The Color of Food. Side note, it is not because I happen to be mentioned in it, but because it is this incredible documentary project that was led by a young woman, farmer of color, and she loaded up her van, drove all across the country interviewing various farmers of color, and then brought it all together into a beautiful book.
Wow.
I just think it tells a really soulful portrait of food and agriculture, but just it's a story of our times and
a hopeful one.
The people in there are incredible, and it's a hopeful one. It's a hopeful one.
Awesome. Okay, if you had to boil all your work into a one-line message, like if you were to write a book today that was just one page and one sentence that was supposed to encapsulate all this, all that you're working on, what would that one line read?
All right. This is, I guess, more of a question. One-liner. I'm a cheesy person, but this comes to me is, what kind of ancestor do you want to be?
Ooh, that's deep. I like that. Wow, that's the first question we've had ever. Why? So I know I said this is rapid fire, but why did you use the word ancestor?
I think about one of my mentors and teachers, and she would often kind of bring up this question of retracing family roots and thinking about the future and thinking about the past. She's an earth historian. That's a whole nother tangent, but she's incredible. But through her, I remember, when I was in my late teens, early 20s, as a student, she'd introduce me to this concept of thinking about DNA. And now I can't remember whose quote it was, but was thinking about DNA as descendants, now ancestors. And I just was like so hooked on that as a 19-year-old. It's like, whoa, thinking about yourself, even as a young person, to think you're an ancestor, not just if you biologically have children, which not everyone wants to or is going to, but just what is your legacy in the bigger picture, even wherever you happen to be, in your own lifespan. And when you're gone, what imprint have you left?
So this is a compliment. I don't mean this in any disparaging sense at all, but you keep reminding me of the monk in Korea who farms.
Actually the monk, you have reached the
Because no, I laugh because like she said something very similar, you know. She's like, when I cook, I see the past, the present, and the future because I see my grandmother who cooks through me. But I'm also, even though she doesn't have any kids, she's like, this is the food that someone else long into the future is going to be cooking, or the same ingredients, or if you really want to look at it in some metaphysical sense, like my cells are going to be someone's food one day. So I'm like, damn. You should really stop saying it's cheesy, because I think it's super deep. I think it should be a shirt, actually.
Okay,
But
fine. I'll just say, hey, guess what? This is super deep. You ready?
okay.
I can't wait to watch this month's interview. Alternate lives.
I know, I've just planted in your head now. So that is pretty much it. The last question is very t two last ones. First one is very logistical. Where else can people follow your story other than the Suriwa website? Any
Yeah.
personal Instagrams, Facebooks, wherever?
Instagram is open. I have one under Eileen Suzara,
Okay.
and I've decided to also set one up just for Suriwa that's fully food focused.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay,
And,
perfect.
yeah.
I will link those. So this last question is very unorthodox. I don't usually ask anything beyond this logistical one, but when I was reading your blog, which is fantastic, by the way, there was one particular paragraph that really touched me, because I think this is something that a lot of people, including myself, struggle with. And not just around food, but I think around fear and going after what you want in particular. So forgive me, but I'm going to have to read part of it to set up the context. And I think this was the report or the article you wrote about getting interviewed by Al Jazeera, I believe it was.
Oh, okay.
Right. So there was the in the towards the end, you described how you were being interviewed and how this reporter wasn't going to let you off very easily. So the paragraph reads, "The reporter was kind yet relentless. She asked what the dream would look like and how much it would really cost to get there. She told me that the 30s are the best. I said thank you. And she asked what was keeping me from a life that included farming. By this point, I decided she was not a real reporter at all and instead must be some ordained voice from the universe asking the unsightly but real questions we hide from ourselves like dirty socks under the bed." So that really touched me because I think everyone has this issue of dirty socks under the bed that someone has to come to us, to the voice of the universe. For you, it was the reporter. For me, it was a good friend who also is a farmer, Ayesha, who exposes the dirty socks under the bed. What would you say is the dirtiest sock under your bed today?
Oh, what? You want to go there? Let's go there. I love this
We're
question. You are
closing it
so
out.
unorthodox.
We're closing it out with that.
The dirtiest sock under the bed. I think one of the dirtiest socks under the bed is maybe similar to some of the other socks that were there before, which is the fear and hesitation of, can you really, do you have the right to actually go after what you want? And it's a funny thing because sometimes we could go through our lives and on the outside appear to be going after the things that you want, but then on the inside sometimes wonder like, who the hell gave you permission to go after the things you want? And sometimes that sock, you know, rears its dirty little cottony head and, you know, makes me think, oh, what the hell am I doing? I should have picked a far more clear path. Is it too late to, you know, backpedal and jump off of this ship and do something far more stable? Mm-hmm. And I think just trying to understand that sock is something that still comes up during moments of doubt, during times when it seems that the political situation is going to destabilize a lot of things where we are. But I ultimately also think that when we have to confront these unsightly parts of our own psyche or our own doubt or neuroses or whatever, it hopefully can always just push the work forward harder to be like, well, I don't know where you came from, dirty sock, but I'm going to throw you in the laundry or at least push you further down the pile for now.
And with that, this was an epic episode, I will say. Thank you so much.